Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September the 16th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Evelyn String. The title of the session is Literary Landscapes, Stories That Reflect. The tape number is 99-2. Let's listen in on Evelyn String's story.
Week I did something about celebrating the creation, scriptural viewpoints on the environment. This week I've been doing all kinds of different things. I'm a generalist, not a specialist in anything. And so this week I've done Katie Luther, and I did Chile and Argentina slides and so on. And this morning I'm calling this Literary Landscapes. Why? All right, I'm retired as a professor. I've always enjoyed reading. And now that I'm retired, I am reading things that I want to read, rather than just the professional reading that you absolutely have to do if you're in, you know, any profession where you have to keep up, where you must keep up and read the journals and the periodicals and so on. So, come on in. And so I am enjoying leisure reading, having time and discovering authors that I did not know before. I'm being blessed still with decent eyesight, which is a gift among other things. Not everyone can do that either. But I enjoy reading. And so there will be time for you to share some of your special things. Now, the reason I selected this title is because one of the things I taught, and which I might have some credentials in, is geography. And I very much enjoy books in which the natural environment, or the even an urban environment, makes a difference. And I think if the author does it well, to use the environment, the setting, and works it in, that for me makes a book somewhat authentic. I do like mysteries. I know one time I picked up one of those long airport waits, you know, where things take longer, and I picked up a book that I thought, oh, this should be good. It's a mystery set in Mexico. And so the book starts out, the main character steps out of a taxi in Mexico City into the hot steaming air. And I decided he had not been in Mexico City, because I've spent a lot of time in Mexico City, and a hot, steamy day at that elevation is very unusual. He was a British writer, and as I went on, he was sort of putting down other parts of Mexico. I had an attitude there. I thought, this person has not really lived in that environment to write authentically about it. Sometimes you can spot the phonies, and I thought that one was a phony, and I've chosen to forget its name. Its name, but right. All right, there's a lot of popular fiction, and I hope some of you have found some of these, in which the setting makes a difference. Some of the books that you can find here in paperback are the books by Jan Caron. How many of you have read some of these? You enjoy them?
Yes.
I think they're wonderful books.
That's the, what's your name? They call it the...
Mitford. At Home in Mitford.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, really,
I have read all the ones that are out. The bookstore here has, this is the first one, At Home in Mitford, and then These High Green Hills, and A Light in the Window, and Out to Canaan, and then the new one is, trying to remember its name, but in that the setting changes. Being a geographer, I like maps. Now, Jan Caron, K-A-R-O-N, has created a fictitious town. Mm-hmm. And in some of the books, she has a map of the places, so you can sort of visualize that. But it is authentic because she lives in Blowing Rock, North Carolina. I've been there, and the hills, the vegetation, the garden flowers, everything is authentic. And she works that into her writing. In the latest, the new book, what is it called? Where Father Tim, the Episcopal priest, who is the hero of this, where he and the bride he acquires at a late age, later on, where he's retired now and he's now serving an interim in the coastal area. And I think she spent some time in the coastal area because the way she describes the hurricanes and everything like that. But that's what I mean by authentic writing, where really the setting is an integral part of the story. I personally enjoy that kind of thing. I enjoy Tony Hillerman. You know Tony Hillerman?
Yes.
Now, I particularly enjoy it because that's the American Southwest, mm-hmm. New Mexico and Arizona. And I know that a lot of the places fairly well where this takes place. Furthermore, he has spent a lot of time with the Native Americans there, and his characters in most of the books. Now, he's done others with other settings, but in most of the books are authentic. You learn something about the religion and the practices. Also, the bookstore has a lot of Tony Hillerman books. And the latest, which I've just finished, which I've loaned to Ruth,
I started last night. I no longer have to study medieval history for a while. I can read Tony Hillerman. Yeah. And having been in the Four Corners, it is so nice to go back to that territory.
And if you haven't been there, it gives you a feel of the landscape. Yes.
Another person who does this extremely well, Bodie Caney.
Now, I want to take down names, and you all may want to, as we go along, pick up suggestions. Who are you naming?
Bodie Caney, you spell B-O-D-I-E, I believe, and then T-H-O-E-N-E. It looks like phone.
Uh-huh.
But she has, and her husband, worked together in the research, and they've done really authentic research, and they give you a sense of the Jewish history, but the first one, Vienna Prelude, is of a young violinist in Vienna who has been sent there by her parents, and they are in Germany yet, and very war heroes of the First World War. It takes you from the time of before Hitler and how the stature of this hero is down to the point where he's in a concentration camp, takes you all the way through them helping children escape and going from there into the countries that Hitler prance to. And then the Zion Chronicles that she has also takes you through the birth of Israel, mm-hmm. and the beginning, mm-hmm. and the Palestinian and the Israeli, and now to see how it's reversed, the mm-hmm. Zionists mm-hmm. are being, it gave me a sense of history that I just haven't been able to grasp out of the history books.
Sometimes, yeah. And these are fiction now, sometimes they
Yeah, Western, the High Tierras, the early gold rush days of our country. And so, really, right.
Okay, all right.
Authentic.
It helps if they've been there.
Yeah.
It helps if they've been there. Thank you. Well, you mentioned the history of Israel. Of course, James Michener has been one of my favorite writers for a long time, and I've read most, just about all of the things that he has done. His very latest ones were not as good as earlier ones. In his later years, like his book on Mexico, was sort of rewarmed. That wasn't that good. But where Michener has spent a lot of time in a particular area researching that, like in Israel, since you mentioned that, he spent a lot of time in a kibbutz. And his tell that he describes in the beginning is really Megiddo, I think, unless it's Hatzor. It's one of the two. I've forgotten which one. He sort of combines the qualities of these authentic archaeological sites, and he traces, of course, much of the history, that kind of thing, so that someone who has lived in the environment, sometimes he will just transform a name. How many of you read Centennial Missioners, which I think is one of his better ones? Centennial is really, really Colorado, in a way. So he used that, sort of, and transformed it. And of course, he starts out with the dinosaurs in the swamp, in that, which is sort of interesting. But I think Michener is an illustration of an author who really not only uses a home setting, but since Michener, you know, was an orphan, you know, and he moved around to different places. He had no particular family ties. So he moved to a place and did the research. Sometimes the local people where he does the research are not real happy with some of the stories he's told. I am with a daughter-in-law who is from Maryland. When he did Chesapeake, she said that some of the people didn't like some of the stories that he had because they were too close to maybe truth or skeletons in the closet or something like that. But
I wasn't happy with his missionary presentation in Hawaii either.
No.
Well, Hawaii, on Hawaii, two different times I took students from Texas Lutheran on January term to Hawaii and always had them read Hawaii. But it was very hard on the missionaries. And Missioner later on said that he thought he was too hard on the missionaries. He sort of recanted. But of course, that doesn't appear in the books.
Right.
I mean, they were very prim and, you know, New Englanders who wanted people to dress like they do in New England, if you read Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But it was the idea that he did recognize he made some mistakes. Oh, I shouldn't really say this, but you know where Mishner chose to retire and where he died?
No.
Austin, Texas. Okay. Don't call that chauvinism. I'm just mentioning it. Okay. I know that. Anybody here from Minnesota? Well, of course, what would you do without Garrison Keillor? But Garrison Keillor does the Lutheran scene. But I'm sure you know John Hassler, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I just discovered John Hassler a few years ago thanks to a friend who had moved from Minnesota. And I just bought this in the bookstore and I'm going to read it on the way home. So forget Garrison Keillor and the Cone Brothers. John Hassler is Minnesota's most engaging cultural export. And of course, he has more of a Catholic community in some of his, which gives another perspective other than the Lutherans. And the blurb here on the front says that if Lake Wobegon had a college, it would be Rookery State. And that's a review from Minneapolis Star and Tribune. Well, I think here is a regional writer, again, like Garrison Keillor and Hassler and so on, who have really brought the environment into it. And you Minnesotans know Hassler's books?
Well, I love reading them, but he doesn't give the Lutherans a break that Keillor gives
them. No, he has this doubt. Now, one of his books I read, I thought, that isn't that good. The earlier one,
Staggerford.
Yeah, Staggerford, I think. Yeah, some of his earlier books have been better, but we'll see what this one is like. Some of them, though, are on college campuses because he is or has been a college prof. And so knowing some of the situation from the inside, you can be authentic again about what you're saying. Well, we've had another illustration of a regional writer from you people from the Northwest, who is one that has done a lot authentically of the Northwest recently.
Well, Gooderson.
Gooderson, what do you know about him?
Snow Falling on Cedars.
Yes.
It's about one of the islands in the San Juans. Wrote about the Japanese, a little murder in between, and how the Japanese people interfaced with the white people or not. He lives around here. I'm not exactly sure where he lives, but he's Northwestern. He's written a new book, too, something east.
There's a new one there, which people who've read it say it's pretty complicated, because even in the other one, Snow Falling Over Cedars, he flips back and forth in time, and you have to sort of keep track of where you are. But when I was at Holden 2 years ago, I was told, you must read Snow Falling Over Cedars because it is really giving you the feel of part of the Northwest. So I got the book, and his place, his location, is San Pedro Island, which he describes. Well, I looked in my book. It says San Pedro was an island of 5,000 damp souls named by lost Spaniards who moored offshore in the year 1603. They'd sailed in search of the Northwest Passage and so on. Well, the San Juan Islands, that is a Spanish name. Mm-hmm. My friend Hildegard Dengler says very definitely San Pedro is Lopez Island, yes, where the Danglers live.
Mm-hmm.
And see, so a writer, I think this is an illustration of maybe being a little safer to make a fictitious island. Even has a map of it at the front. I didn't bring my book, but I have it at home. Even has a map of the island, except that it's Lopez Island. So I think it's interesting, I'm having fun seeing how authors will take a landscape and maybe name something different. Like Jan Caron, you see, Blowing Rock is probably Medford, you know, transformed a little bit or something, which is quite authentic. Those of you who know the San Juan Islands, this is Ishmael, it's toward the end. Beneath the stars, with his overcoat on, he wandered out into the cold. His feet took their own direction through the cedar woods, and underneath a canopy of branches, he smelled the old fragrance of the place of his youth and the clean scent of the newly fallen snow. Here under the trees, it was fresh and untouched. The branches of the cedars were hung with it, and beyond them, the sky lay immaculate and decembral, the stars chilled points of light. He followed his feet to where the path met the beach, where a wall of honeysuckle bloomed in summer, intertwined with salmon berries and wild roses. Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got those here. And cut through the dell of snow-covered ferns to the hollow cedar tree of his youth, and so on. That's almost part of the walks around here, isn't it? Yes.
I give you a different opinion as a native Northwesterner, that the island is actually Bainbridge Island, which
right.
is not in the San Juan. If you take that map that shows the San, what is the name they give it?
San Pedro.
If you look at that map and then look at an actual map of the San Juans, there is no island there.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be similar, you know, people living on Lopez may see a lot of similarities, but the history is actually the history of Bainbridge. That's where the Japanese had the strawberry
yes.
line.
Okay.
That's where they were deported from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he just took, but the advantage of having a fictional island is that he could create his own geography
yeah.
for
yeah.
the places, and it also means that people don't tramp all over Bainbridge Island looking for this place under the tree where he met his girl and all that.
And it also reduces the chance of too many lawsuits.
Yes, that's right.
That's the bigger concern.
Thank you. So Bainbridge and not Lopez, I'll have to tell But what the region, it's authentic
yeah.
to the
region. Oh yes, it's authentic to the region, except that I don't know if they ever had that kind of extensive strawberry growing in the San Juans.
Uh-huh.
But Bainbridge,
yeah,
water is such
that.
A problem out there, yeah.
Yeah.
I wondered about that.
But certainly the fishing and all, you know, the
fishing.
Atmosphere.
There's Anacortes for the furry. I mean, that
mm-hmm.
fits a lot of places.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
well, you know, making your own island, fictional island, you know, Michener did that in Chesapeake. He has this old plantation built out on this, one of the sort of the islands in the Chesapeake, and has the story of the family on this plantation, and the old plantation is house is falling down kind of, and at the very end of the book the island disappears, and I went there one time and took a picture of where Michener's island was. I mean, he places it very exactly, except there's no island there. And that is the history of the Chesapeake on the Atlantic coast, that islands appear and disappear over several hundred years. So, you know, you're safe that way. You don't pinpoint the exact island or something like that. Well, we've had some wonderful presentations on medieval life. And I am real pleased that I think now I have read every one of Ellis Peters' brother,
Gadvo. I have a Welsh granddaughter, and the F is pronounced
V.
All right, Gadvo, and it's the Shrewsbury.
Shrewsbury, or Shrewsbury in English, if you look the ordinary, but you know the British, like B-A-T-H is not bass. It's Boss.
Even the gal who introduces it mispronounces it.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, on that too, in my opinion. But in terms of the setting, there's usually a map in there. There's usually a map in there.
Of
this 12th century kind of thing. I have been through that town, but that was before I knew the books and before some of them were written. And I understand now it has become a tourist town.
Oh, sure.
Where you can buy T-shirts with Brother
Gadvo.
all right, and the whole bit. I had a, well, someone I met actually from northern Minnesota who had come to Texas for something said her daughter's high school choir went to Shrewsbury, among other things, and they sang in what remains of the abbey, I guess, or the church, because the acoustics were so wonderful. But I mean, it's become that kind of tourist thing. And so another idea in this, obviously, is that sometimes a fairly obscure place, in this case, authentic site, she does not change the name. Ellis Peters, of course, is a woman, does not change the name, but it has made it a tourist site, whether that's good or not. There are a lot of these in the bookstore, not all of them.
It was a charming city anyway.
Pardon me?
It's a charming city anyway.
Yeah. And right on the Welsh borderlands. And in the library I found two I had not read. I felt my judgment affirmed when I got very much interested in them, because in taking a trip with Ed Krentz, a retired professor of theology, a great classic scholar at the Lutheran School of Theology, Chicago, he admitted he is a fan of this series and that he has all of them and has read all of them. So I felt, okay, if a noted theologian can approve those, fine.
What I really liked about the series, the PBS series, was how much grace they allowed in this public broadcasting program. Was marvelous to hear this message of forgiveness.
I mean, these are mysteries. There's always a murder in there, but they have a Christian message, even if it comes out of the 12th century, which I think. And Jan Caron's books, I mean, the same thing, have a message of just grace and scripture quotation. And Barnabas the dog, who was pretty unruly and big, and when Father Tim quotes scripture to him, Barnabas shapes up. Well, humor also, obviously. But
I feel so much better now. I've been so hung up on Ellis Peters, and I thought, I must be like, what's going on with me that I like all this so much? And I find I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I find two in the library here I hadn't read. You know, they're hard to get. I search bookstores for titles I haven't read because some of them are out of print. Found two, and I think that does it. So, you know, never know what you find in the hold in the library. All right, I think it's obvious that for some books, the setting might not make a lot of difference, that you can transfer it. A classic is Romeo and Juliet, right? Romeo and Juliet were moved from Verona. When you go to Verona and they'll show you Juliet's balcony and all of that kind of thing. I don't know if Shakespeare ever got there. But look what Leonard Bernstein did with Romeo and Juliet. West Side Story, right? West Side Story. So a good story can have different settings, and so maybe the setting was not as important there as the story. Earlier this year, I was asked to do a book review of a book which is entitled Literary Landscapes, which I would really recommend for any library, except that I've tracked it down and it's out of print, which is very unfortunate. It is an atlas, really, and a literary background of the British writers. And it shows how everybody from Dickens to the Brontes to the late poets and so on, how intimately much of their writing was involved with the natural setting. I reread Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights just a few months ago, which is a little morbid, right? Did you ever read that? Some of these things we read maybe back in high school. I know I read it back then, and I, you know, didn't.
Did you walk to Wuthering Heights?
Pardon me?
Have you walked to
Wuthering? I have been in that area, not precisely there, but I bet you bicycled.
Well, we walked up through the moors and, you know, to that spot, and it is fantastic to, because it's a remoteness in a very different way, a desolateness.
Yeah. So the Emily Bronte and her family, I mean her sisters, of course she wrote under a male name in those days. I mean you wouldn't use, you know, a woman's name kind of thing. But this particular book says that probably no novel is so saturated in the atmosphere of a particular kind of countryside as that is. It's in Yorkshire. And even reading it, if you haven't been there, you almost picture the land, you almost feel the land. So that is one illustration. In Dickens.
Charlotte Bronte is, by the way, Rochester Towers. You know, you could go to Rochester and experience also that feeling of this great castle, which is now empty and burned out, you know, empty.
The
Bronte. And feel the burning out of that castle.
Have you sometimes gone back to books that you read early in childhood and didn't get very much out of them, and then you go back and say, hey, you know, I have a new perspective on that? And particularly if you've been to the site, then it's fun to, yeah, this makes much more sense.
Sure.
One of the points that is made also about that this book has a chapter on the blackening of England, that some of the writers of the time when the Industrial Revolution was coming in were being aware of what was happening to the natural setting. Here's one, where coal mines were being opened and coal was now powering factories which were being established, and before anybody thought about clean air or anything like that, the countryside was being blackened. Here is one. Scene of superfluous grace and wasted bloom, O violated coal brook, it's a place, in an hour to beauty unpropitious and to song, the genius of thy shades by Plutus bribed, amid thy grassy lanes, thy wildwood glens, thy knolls and bubbling wells, thy rocks and streams, slumbers, whole tribes, fugiliginous invade the soft, romantic, consecrated scenes. Now we view their fresh, their fragrant, and their silent reign, usurped by cyclops. Hear in mingled tones, shout their thronged barge, their ponderous engines clang through thy coy dales, while red the countless fires with umbered flames thicker on all thy hills, darkening the summer sun with columns large, a thick sulfurous smoke which spread like palls that screen the dead upon thy sylvan robe of thy aspiring rocks, pollute thy gales and stain thy glassy waters.
Sounds
wow,
like hell.
That's 1785. Now, that, you know, the language is a little foreign to us, but it certainly is a picture of a poetic reaction to what is called the blackening of England, where the industrial age was just clobbering the environment.
I bicycled through Coverdale, you know, and it's now green and lovely, but it was a hell. It was a hell of a time.
The disaster that happened. I remember being at Aberfan, which is a later event, where the coal tipple of the stuff, you know, this waste had just been piled very high. You remember that story? They had just piled coal slag, the separated rock that they separated from the coal, like the slates and things, on a very high slope, which went beyond the angle of repose.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
It
slid down right on the town's schoolhouse.
Oh, that's in Wales.
And got all the children.
Near Merthyr Tydfil.
Yeah, Merthyr Tydfil, right. And so now they have landscaped, that's in Wales, they have landscaped it and as a memorial, I mean, and they're not doing it that way anymore. But even, you know, in this century, that kind of thing happening to the environment where people were responding. Dickens had a lot of his writings reflect the changes that were going on at the time, changes to the environment. Anyway, if you can ever find this book, I have the data here, Literary Landscapes of the British Isles. It's really a narrative atlas if you're into at all British literature, the classic stuff we studied in high school, or college. It's a wonderful background of having all kinds of maps and things.
Did that include D.H. Lawrence in the coal deal? Because he would, you know, he lived in, his father was a coal miner. He talks about the plight of the people and mm-hmm. how they lived in that area. It was just, you know, when you mentioned the blackening, I think of D.H. Lawrence.
Yeah, yeah. So there are just a lot of illustrations there in terms of reaction. And then also we could take the late poets and how they responded to the natural environment and the trying to being inspired by it and writing about it. It was the late poets, it was so named, weren't calling themselves that, but Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Southey. And particularly Wordsworth is the most of the best known of the late poets. And you remember, I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. And so when you read some of these poets especially, you see pictures of things. One of my memorable mornings is being in that country on a beautiful sunny morning that could have been like a Holden morning, being by the little church where Wordsworth is buried, and bought a little pocket volume of Wordsworth poems and sat on a stone fence right outside the little church, where churchyard where he's buried, and I read Wordsworth. And this was the scene that I saw, and it just sort of represented what he loved, but he was also seeing the blackening of England and the Industrial Revolution coming in there. And the poem that I've often quoted in relation to environmental things, I have to think of Wordsworth being disturbed by what was happening to so much of the countryside. That's taken from a slide. And early last week I quoted this poem, which many of you know, I've often quoted it. The world is too much with us.
Late
and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. What's he saying? The church? Christianity is not paying attention to what is happening in the environment. Earlier people, we call pagans, pantheists, whatever, they were seeing gods or symbols of gods in the sea, in the winds and whatever. They were sensitive to nature. They saw something sacramental in nature. They saw something holy in nature. And at that time, the church was not paying attention to what was happening to the natural environment. When he says, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn than being the kind of Christian who sees nothing in nature except the exploit. It's a pretty strong statement, which is why I've used it often in terms of the history of the environmental thing when the earth didn't matter, you know, it was just to be used for people. All right, there is another thing that we've said in terms of, well, since we brought up scripture here, certainly you can't read scripture, especially Hebrew scriptures, without being aware that the writers reflected things about the environment. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about rivers of life and water. This is from a slide and a rod. Sheep and shepherd. And I don't know what those sheep are finding to eat. But those of you who have been to Israel know that they have a water problem, right? It's pretty dry. And therefore, as you read Hebrew scriptures, the presence of water is seen as a gift. Wells are important. Wells are something that might be fought over. The idea of casting somebody like Hagar cast out into the desert. Well, the wilderness years for the Exodus, thing that Ruth referred to in the Vespers last night, being the thirsting for God. Well, only people maybe who live in real dry countries really know thirst. So that a lot of our imagery in scripture relates to the natural environment, particularly when it's dry. The references like dry as the thirsty land where there is no water. So you can carry this image idea and the scriptural writers using the natural environment, I think very often. Rocks that stood out because there wasn't as much vegetation, so you have a lot of rock imagery. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I. God is my rock and my salvation. That's what they were seeing, so that kind of setting.
Well, also certain particular rocks.
Yes.
Had particular purpose and particular qualities.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were like people.
Yeah. So however scripture came about, I mean, we say divine inspiration or whatever, but the human beings who were writing it down were sensitive to their setting and their natural environment, and it's reflected. It is reflected in the writing. Yeah. Any comments on that further? Okay, things you learn on Elder Hostel. Another illustration. How many of you admit to having read Evangeline? Longfellow's Evangeline. You've always got to be my generation when we used to read it in high school, kind of thing. Longfellow's Evangeline. I did an elder hostel in Nova Scotia last fall. I had a frequent flyer that could take me, so I decided to go as far as it would take me to admit in Nova Scotia, which helped for an elder hostel. And one of the courses was on Evangeline, or Evangeline, as they call it there. Nova Scotia, as you know, was formerly called Acadia by the French. It alternated between French and British or English rule until the Peace of Utrecht in 1783. It was ceded to the English. The inhabitants were mainly French farmers and fishermen. And so the English settlement was Halifax, and actual history is that in 1775 there was an order of the British governor to summon all the males into the church at Grand Prix, and the order was announced for removal, and in haste the families were separated and dispersed to North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Louisiana. Right, Louisiana. Well, Hawthorne is supposed to have heard a story of a couple that were separated in this. They were engaged to be married. They were just about to be married with the order given, everybody out. The families were separated. That much is history. He shared this story with Longfellow, who let it settle for a while and made it into a poem. Now, Longfellow never visited Nova Scotia, but this was from the first edition from 1847. Since then, there have been 300 editions. Longfellow's bust is the only one of an American in Westminster Abbey, I have been told. I haven't checked that out. The only bust of an American in Westminster Abbey. Does someone know if that's true? What this book did, Literary Landscape, was to, first of all, establish American poetry. Now, yeah, this isn't the way our poetry goes now, but you know how it starts. What? This is the forest primeval, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks, bearded with moss and in garments green, indistinct in the twilight, stand like druids of old, with voices sad and prophetic, stand like the harper's whore, with beards at rest on their bosoms. Loud from its rocky caverns, the deep-voiced neighboring ocean speaks, and in accents disconsolate answers the wail of the forest. And naught but tradition remains of the beautiful village of Grand Pre. And another part, the first, that's the introduction. In the Acadian land on the shores of the basin of Minas, this distant, secluded, still, the little village of Grand Pre lay in the fruitful valley. Vast meadows stretched to the eastward, giving the village its name, and pasture the flocks without number, dikes at the hands of the farmers had raised with labor incessant, and so on. There was a real village. There were French farmers and fishermen removed. The Bay of Minas and that area, or Bay of Minas, either one, is a bay on the Bay of Fundy, which has the highest tides in the world. We saw a tidal interval of 52 feet in high feet and high tide and low tide. Happened to be the highest for the year. This poem made that a literary landscape because it gave the, Longfellow was never there. So there are some inaccuracies in describing it because he talks in that very first about the deep-voiced ocean resounding in the caverns. You don't have that kind of cliff where you'd have sea cliffs where there are caverns in the ocean. But what has happened is that Evangeline, the literature, the book, has become a cultural hero for the Acadians. All kinds of movies were made based on Longfellow's story, starting in 1913. Later on, they did some others. Any of you remember the name Dolores Del Rio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was one Evangeline. She sat for a statue. The Canadian Railroad put up this statue. This is the reconstructed church at Grand Pre in Nova Scotia. They call her the patron saint of tourism. In other words, what a book has done, a place. Yes. It's the Windsor Hansport Railroad that still runs the Evangeline Express excursion. The replica church is not consecrated, it's a museum. When I was there, they were doing a video for the schools. It is a national historic site. They're excavating the ruins of the village. All kinds of people come to Grand Pre, because of a book, which is a fictitious story, but with some mistakes in the natural environment, but it has made that she is a cultural hero for the Acadians. Mm-hmm. All right, now in the poem, you know, Evangeline and Gabriel, the lovers who are separated right before their marriage, right? They're separated and they do not find each other until later on, way in Philadelphia, she is working in the poorhouse where the dead and dying are brought, the sick hospital. Here is this gone figure before her, and they are reunited at the very end, kind of thing, in Philadelphia. Okay, in Louisiana, this story has been retold in different ways, different versions. They will show you, I have a daughter in Louisiana, they will show you her grave. And as they say, don't tell anybody in Louisiana that that is not Evangeline's grave. This is a fictitious, but they take them very serious.
Just don't try.
They have now had a World Congress of Acadians, which meets in alternate years, where people of Acadian heritage, the French who were kicked out of Nova Scotia, New Scotland, are finding pride in their heritage and getting together. They meet in alternate years, either at Grand Prix or in Louisiana. They just met in Louisiana last month. My son-in-law sent me clippings of the big doings in Louisiana. And so in Louisiana then, you've got all kinds of things. And you look at names, in Nova Scotia, you can have an Evangeline dairy, you've got Evangeline this, all kinds of products, candy bars. Also in Louisiana, you've got Evangeline County, you've got, they showed us a video of, I mean, there must be about 50 products that have the name Evangeline. But I thought it was an interesting illustration, things you learn at Elder Hostel, about how a book which has a particular setting and which does move from, in this case, Nova Scotia, a real place, but fictitious characters, it could have happened that way, to Louisiana, has made big deals for tourism, but also cultural identity. Because the Cajuns in Louisiana have not always been considered the first-class citizens. They've had this sort of their own culture. And so they are the Acadians, and it has given them pride in their culture. So, you know, literary landscapes, it's amazing what books can do, making a difference. Well, what books do you have to talk about or recommend further that really use landscapes or that you've enjoyed? Yes.
George MacDonald, the Scottish.
Scottish.
It has been translated, but they put leave a lot of Scotch any talk in there and language, I should say. They are pretty old, but they're being.
Yeah, it's fun to rediscover old books because, like I said, I had read some version of this in high school and going back to this old house, rereading it. Okay, that is really neat. It has a lot of good images and some good. If you haven't read Evangeline, pick it up sometime. I mean, you know, the language is a little stilted, but it's well worth reading again. First printed in, what did we say, in 1847. It's worth rereading, yeah. Yes, another one.
Well, Edward Rutherford wrote Sarum, which is the history of the area around Salisbury, England.
Yes.
I read it, and then we were able to go there and came back, and I grabbed the book and read it again, because now it meant a lot more when I had seen them. It starts from prehistoric settlement all the way down to the present. And now he's done the same thing with London. And I think he also has a book out about Russia. Sort of like going to be an English James Michener, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, I did read Sarah. And I because he started at the beginning, right?
Prehistoric.
You know, in London, not far from St. Paul's, I think, is the Museum of the City of London, where after the bombing and stuff, they found a lot of things that go way back, and so they've told the history of London. So if you go to London, the Museum of the History of the City of London, I think it's called, shows you sort of that kind of thing. Yeah. Other things you'd like to recommend?
Ivan Doig's books are here. D-O-I-G, Ivan Doig. And this is the western part of Montana, going into the mountains. His dad was a forest ranger, and so he knew that. He grew up in it. And have any of you read Ivan Doig? Just very, very much into the geography, into the territory. He's got several books, very readable. And he lives in Seattle now.
D-O-I-G?
D-O-I-G.
Mm-hmm. D-O-I-G, okay.
And I think he's in the library. I've seen him here.
There's one book in the bookstore, too.
I know, somewhere, yeah.
Of course, Willa Cather. Mm-hmm. One memorable time, I think one of the last trips my husband and I were able to take together, we went to San Fe and bought a copy again of Death Comes for the Archbishop. And the driving through those big spaces, we took turns reading out loud. Whoever wasn't driving was reading to the other, you know, because that, and of course, my Antonia and others said in Nebraska and whatnot, Willa Cather or Cather, I never know which, C-A-T-H-E-R. You can go to her home, where is it, someplace in Nebraska, Red.
Yeah, Wallace Stegner, too.
And Wallace Stegner from the California. Mm-hmm.
And Laura Ingalls Wilder, I was crazy about that.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. And all the children's books that are wonderful. There are a lot of new editions of her books for children that are great. Yes.
Anybody heard of Craig Meyer?
What did you say?
Craig Meyer.
Meyer.
He would be a regional writer, but the blurbs on his book come from the East Coast and the West Coast, so I think he's gotten a little farther from Minnesota. He comes from Morgan. He was born and raised on a farm in Morgan, Minnesota, or near Morgan, and which is just a short distance from Jackpot Junction, which is very close to the headquarters of the Southwest Synod of the Minnesota Synod.
Okay.
But anyhow, he's Catholic, but his books, the one that I had my attention called to first was one, The Witness of Combines.
Hmm.
Now, he comes from a far background.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, he's in his late 40s, and he's teaching at Spearfish University or College in South Dakota, out in the Black Hills, right now. But he writes out of a background of farming, and his books, at least a couple of them that I've seen now, are biographical. I guess you'd call it he's a philosopher, and he writes out of his history and his background, and it's very readable. I just happened to catch in the paper, our local major newspaper in southern Minnesota, the Mankato Free Press, that he was going to be giving a reading at Barnes & Noble on a Sunday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So made it a point to be down at a church in Mankato where I was served as assisting pastor for about 6 years after retirement. And then from there over to Barnes & Noble. And it was delightful hearing him reading from this book. The thing is, he said he had been writing for about 20 years. He never had any published until this last year, three books. Just like that. So he's real hot right now.
And we've been talking mainly about fiction, but then there are other books which are not fiction in that sense, but bring in a lot of spirituality. I'm thinking of Kathleen Norris. I mean, her books are here. I mean, Dakota is very geographic, her first.
Lemon, South Dakota.
Yes, yes. It's very geographic, and I also recommended it to our associate bishop in Southwestern Texas Synod. Today. Any pastor going for the first time into a rural parish way out there must read this book. He read it and he agreed in terms of the idea. I mean, Kathleen Norris brings in so much of the setting, especially in Dakota. And the second one, The Cloister Walk, and then Amazing Grace. I have all three,
The thing I enjoyed about the Bodhi Taney books were not only the physical landscape of what, and the historical landscape, but the spirituality of the people and how the Christian Palestinian neighbors and interacted with the Jewish neighbors and the American archaeologists that were present in the story, and how they interacted to bring the Christian message to them, and how throughout the book, even in her Western Western stories, it shows God acting in the lives of these people, the missionary son that came over to the Wild Wild West. It's real, real picturesque. You can almost see the mud on the boardwalks, you know, and the it's
of the landscape, everything. It's just, I see the pictures of the different places all months and months after I read the book.
One of the things I had proposed doing at Holden and then chickened out because I didn't see how I could do it was to talk about Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible.
Oh, yes.
Because it's not out in paperback
yet. Yes,
and it is now. Well, it wasn't when we first got into this, and I had asked for it for a Christmas gift. It was $26. And I thought, well, you know, unless you've had enough access to the book, how many of you have read this?
I just finished Bean Tree.
Okay.
I just love
the leaf on the plane on the way out here.
Well, the Poisonwood Bible would be very productive for church groups to discuss. It even has a discussion guide. Because those of you, of course, Kingsolver is a wonderful writer, and some of her writing is set in New Mexico. But this is set in Africa, in what was then the Congo, in the time frame when the revolution was coming. And she lived there for a number of years. So the setting is very authentic. It is a story of Christian mission gone wrong. Why is it called the Poisonwood Bible? Because the poor man, well, you stereotype, I mean, okay, he is a fundamentalist Baptist, okay. But he barges in and uses words that he hasn't quite learned the meaning, and so poisonwood, a word that he thinks is meaning something else, gracious, is actually poisonwood. And he's insisting on baptism in the river, you know, by immersion, when the local people understand that as killing their children because they know there are crocodiles in there. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. It is a story of Christian mission gone wrong. It is a story told in the voices of the women, the wife and the four daughters, and each one reacts differently. It is very definitely in an environment in 1959. It is also funny in places, but it's haunting. And I think I'm going to read it again, even though I got it for Christmas. And it's hard to have a discussion on it unless more people have read it or something. I would recommend, you won't necessarily like everything, but you've read it.
No, but...
Has anybody read this?
I'm looking forward to it now.
Yes, you've read that. What is your opinion about it?
I thought it was wonderful. Yeah. But my copy didn't come with discussion questions in it. I want to go look at yours.
Well, I got this... actually, I first met this book when I was in Nova Scotia at a bookstore. A very nice, because where we were in Nova Scotia was a university and a very nice bookstore. And I saw the book on display and I thought, I'm going to carry on luggage, I won't carry it home. And they had this discussion guide. And the person at the bookstore said, that's the best book I've ever read, which got my attention.
Right.
So that's why I told my son, well, if you must give me a Christmas gift, I would like this book. Yeah. So anyway.
Another one that she's read, I just read, is The Bean Tree of a, is set in Kentucky, or coming over to any southern parts of the states anyway.
Pigs in Heaven.
But this is the one the first one I got acquainted with, I just got introduced to it too. But they gave an excerpt for this Poisonwood Bible just as a family is taking off.
I do think, you know, we talk about devotional reading, and I do that, and I read theology and whatnot. But, you know, we learn something from fiction and by books that are not necessarily religious for a religious purpose. I think one of the best examples of somebody who promoted that was Joe Sittler, the Lutheran theologian in Chicago, who was very, very influential and very, very well read, who would use current literature to show how it reflected the scene. Also, if you read the Christian Century, there are always reviews in there of secular literature, which maybe once in a while we need to read to see what's happening in the outside world. And of course, I like literature that has a setting. So thank you for your sharing.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.